Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and the memo is out. Today, the White House declassified that controversial Republican memo that outlines alleged misconduct at the FBI. It was written by the Republican-led House Intelligence Committee, and it claims the FBI used biased information during its investigation into President Trump's campaign ties to Russia. Let's bring in NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing, who has been reading the memo. Hi, Phil.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And take your time here. What's in it?
It actually is quite like the description you just gave in your intro. You know, there's been so much to-ing and fro-ing and so much Sturm und Drang and kind of prelude to the release of this document. It's a little bit of an anticlimax because it says what everyone expected it would say, which is this. Republicans, led by the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes, make the case that the Justice Department and the FBI basically broke the rules when they asked the secret court that authorizes surveillance on Americans to authorize a warrant on Carter Page. He was the one of the foreign policy advisors from the Trump campaign, whom President Trump introduced in March of 2016. What they say is part of the evidence in that application was the infamous dossier, which NPR has never detailed because it remains unverified, but everybody knows what it says, and that also people involved in the FBI, the Justice Department, and with the drafting of the dossier, the former intelligence officer in Britain who wrote it and the people who hired him in Fusion GPS had been some of the sources for press reports about it. And so in the Republican case, the feds took this unverified and flimsy evidence, some of which was based on circular reporting, if you want to think of it in that way, and that's how they got the memo into evidence, and that's how they got this warrant for Page.
And it seems like already everybody is seeing in this memo what they want to see in this memo. Let's listen to President Trump, who spoke in the White House today after he declassified it.
I think it's terrible. You want to know the truth? I think it's a disgrace. What's going on in this country, I think it's a disgrace. The memo was sent to Congress. It was declassified. Congress will do whatever they're going to do. But I think it's a disgrace what's happening in our country.
What else are you hearing in response?
The Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee and the Democrat who leads the minority on the Senate Intelligence Committee both have released statements this morning basically saying this is a line that can't be uncrossed. You know, the Congress in their telling is using its privileged access to classified foreign intelligence secrets to bake a political argument and as part of a tactical strategy to dirty up the feds and the Justice Department to try to make them look bad and raise doubt about whatever could issue from the investigation that Special Counsel Robert Mueller is doing down the line. But there's a lot more in this memo that's interesting as well. For one thing, it says the FBI investigation was triggered by the now infamous story about an advisor named George Papadopoulos, who received some overtures from Russians very soon after he joined the campaign and then got drunk in London and told an Australian diplomat about them, who then told his ministry, which then told the United States. And it was that that triggered the FBI investigation, not some other contact that we didn't know about before, or in fact, the preparation of this Steele dossier. Mm. Papadopoulos, according to the memo, is where this began.
What does this do to the FBI probe into Trump campaign ties to Russia, Mueller's probe?
Well, that's going to be the thing to watch. Mueller and his investigation are not really affected by this political windstorm that's been taking place. There was a lot of eye-rolling about some headlines on cable TV over the past 24 hours that the release of this document could mean a Friday night massacre in which the director of the FBI and maybe the deputy attorney general might step down in protest. There's been no indication that that could take place. Then again, the day's still young. And in fact, there's other things to dig into here, other evidence. What you may hear people saying is that the applications were signed over and over again for the surveillance of people in the Trump world by both democratically appointed leaders in the Justice Department, the former attorney general, the former FBI director, and Republican appointees, including the deputy attorney general, which indicates that beyond the evidence in the dossier, if in fact that was part of this, they continued to believe that there was sufficient evidence to continue these wiretaps going, the surveillance, which means presumably they must have other evidence that they believe people involved might have been foreign agents or might have had contact with foreign spies.
What do you make of President Trump's statement today? He was asked whether he has confidence in the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, and he just said, you figure that one out.
That's a great question. Nobody knows exactly what to read out of all of this, except for the fact that Rosenstein, as we're talking right now, remains in his job, and the president doesn't appear to have exerted himself toward that end. And according to one of our colleagues, Kerry Johnson, the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, gave a speech today in which he said Rosenstein was doing a great job. He had been in the Justice Department for 27 years, and DOJ really needs that kind of experience, according to Sessions. So he appears to be safe. Wray, the FBI director, appears also to be safe. But, you know, the way this story's been going this week, that could change in 90 minutes or it could change by the end of the day. Who knows?
Will we see the Democrats' rebuttal to this memo?
That's another great question here. The Republicans used their majority on the intelligence panel to authorize the release of this document, which has come out,
right,
but blocked the release of the one that Democrats prepared in response. That appears to stand. The House Speaker has said he doesn't oppose the Democrats' memo coming out eventually, but this Republican one could kind of stand on its own on TV and in newspaper headlines until the Democrats eventually does come out. Right now, we don't know when exactly that might be.
That's NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Phil, thank you.
Thank you.
The hashtags Release the Memo and Memo Day have been trending on social media. For more on these and other threads that are lighting up your news feeds this week, let's bring in Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. She joins us from Washington. Hi, Femi. So as we just heard in Jeremy's discussion, there has been considerable sturm and drang over the release of this memo. But what are you seeing on social media?
I wanted to take us back to where it all started, that hashtag release the memo mm-hmm. hashtag that's really picked up so much momentum. I did something that actually everybody could do, which is go onto an app. And the app is Who Said It First on Twitter. Put in whatever hashtag you're looking for. So in this case, release the memo. Started to appear on January the 18th. Obviously, not a big surprise. That was the day that the House Intelligence Committee voted to allow House members to see the classified document. And you can see a number of people all at the same time coming up with the hashtag. That often happens. But one of the things that really triggered it off was the Republican Senator Steve King of Iowa, when he tweeted that this memo was worse than Watergate. And also, along with that hashtag, release the memo. Let me bring us right up to date. There's a real party going on as far as conservative Twitter is concerned right now. Let me give you a little feeling, a little bit of atmosphere from Lady Liberty. She says, Dems are in panic mode. Release the memo. Memo day. Friday feeling, Groundhog Day, a lot of hashtags there. And right now, just within an hour of this memo going public, hashtag Memo Day is now top of worldwide trends on Twitter.
So, Femi, let me ask you, I mean, in terms of social media's reaction to this, as in many stories, it seems as if we'll be having parallel universes here. But I did note that that there were some Democrats who were saying or concerned that the Release the Memo hashtag was being amplified by bots. Is there any credibility to that?
This is a common rumor that is often used when a Twitter hashtag is a political hashtag. And I have seen that analysis. It's easy to tell because often the Twitter accounts are made up on the same day, very, very local to when the event actually happened. They may not have any history. They may be just eggs. It is an allegation. I have looked a little bit into it, and it may well be true, particularly if we look at Twitter's investigation right now into what happened in the 2016 election. They looked into Russian interference, and they found it.
Yeah. So tell us more about that, because they saw, more than a million users interacted with Russian propaganda during the election.
And these were the ones that they were able to contact. So they contacted Twitter users who they felt absolutely they knew had interacted, liked, followed, engaged with Russian propaganda, and at least 1.5 million had. And these were the ones that they were able to contact. And let me just give you some response from Celestino. And he comments on Twitter, 50,000 Russian bot accounts meddled with US elections. That says it all. Twitter says we can do better. We are going to have more transparency. We are getting ready for the midterm elections. But it does look like the Russian bots, Russian propaganda, deep, deep, deep into our social media platforms, including Twitter.
So 50,000 bots lead to the interactions with 1.4 million users. And then who knows how much that further gets amplified. I mean, there have been people criticizing Twitter for actually kind of trying to downplay the effect of this, haven't there?
But it's easy to see if your account has Russian bots. One is because, as I said, there was no history. But yeah. The other thing you can do is just do a Twitter audit. And you put your Instagram account or your Twitter account into the Twitter audit. It will tell you how many of your followers are real and how many are fake.
I see. Okay.
You can do that straight away.
As soon as I finish talking to you. Okay. Yeah. Well, but since, I mean, today's conversation with you, the theme seems to be bots, let's just really quickly hit another story here about Twitter. That of Richard Roper, the film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times. He was suspended after he reportedly bought, not B-O-T here, but B-O-U-G-H-T, Twitter followers. Tell us about that.
And this came up in a New York Times report looking at followers and fake followers. Richard Roper has a big fan base. They really appreciate his work as a film critic. He's legendary. And underneath the story where the Chicago Sun-Times says we are suspending our film critic, a lot of love for him. Bridget Chambers says this is insipid. Get over it, Sun-Times. You're lucky he writes for you. Scott Olds, this is ridiculous. Who cares?
Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Harvard professors Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt have been studying how authoritarianism rises and democracies fail around the world for years. But after the 2016 presidential election, they turned their attention to the health of America's democracy. And they've put their findings in their new book. It's called How Democracies Die. And their greatest concern is with the responsibility established political parties hold in protecting democratic norms. Daniel Ziblatt began by explaining a kind of litmus test they include in their book. How would you measure authoritarianism in American government today?
If a politician goes after the media, if they endorse violence, if they question the legitimacy of elections, if they threaten their rivals, to lock up their rivals or accuse their rivals of their political rivals of not being loyal to the country, these are clear hallmarks of an authoritarian. In addition to all of the offensive things he's said, you know, at a very basic, minimal level, if a politician does any of those four things that I just listed, we believe that the historical record suggests that establishment politicians must distance themselves from this kind of figure.
When Paul Ryan says, for example, when President Trump maligned a member of the federal judiciary because of his ancestry, and when Paul Ryan says, well, that's textbook racism, but I'm not going to do anything about it, what does that mean for our democracy?
It means that Republicans were abdicating their responsibility, their historic responsibility to defend democracy. Now, establishment Republicans were in a tough place. He won the primary. They didn't have any institutional tools to stop him from winning the primary. So this was not an easy position for someone like Paul Ryan to be in.
And it's remarkable how you point out that before sort of Cold War and earlier, democracies fell in spectacular fashion, right? Military coup, for example. But that it's entirely different after the Cold War. What's that key difference?
The difference is it's far more likely today that democracy dies at the hands of elected leaders, often freely elected ones, who have disarmed democracy after being freely elected, who've used the tools and the institutions of democracy, paradoxically, to kill it or to wound it.
And you give the example, and maybe it's worth walking through it a little bit, of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Sure. Hugo Chavez was freely elected. Hugo Chavez governed in a fairly democratic manner in his initial years in office. But eventually, the Chavez government slowly but surely began to go after the press, to punish independent media, to close down independent media, pack the courts, eventually begin to arrest opponents, exile opponents, and establish what is now a pretty authoritarian regime.
Mm. So I want to ask you, because this idea, in your words, that democratic backsliding can begin at the ballot box is incredibly important for us to understand, because in a sense, you know, there's that old saying that in a democracy, you get the leadership that you deserve. I mean, we were looking back at a January 2016 article from Matthew McWilliams, who was doing research through UMass Amherst. And he did polling across the country, and he wrote in January of 2016 that I have found a single statistically significant variable that predicts whether a voter supports Trump. It's not race, income, or education levels. It's desire for authoritarian leadership.
There is pretty good evidence that Americans have long had an authoritarian streak, whether it's Father Coughlin, whether it's Henry Ford,
George
who flirted
Wallace,
with the presidency,
right.
George Wallace. We argue that it's ultimately the role of party leaders to make sure that demagogues don't get the nomination.
Okay, so then let's look to our own history then. In those other cases, exactly what did the parties do to buttress the democracy in those cases?
So until 1972, party leaders often picked candidates in smoke-filled rooms, which doesn't have a good reputation. Somebody like Henry Ford considered running for president, but it became very clear there was actually a survey done in the 1920s of party leaders, and he was very unpopular with Democratic Party leaders, whereas voters, he was very popular with voters. And so until the 1970s, we had a system in which party leaders picked candidates, and they, you know, and with for all the problems, we're not arguing that we should go back to the system.
I'm saying like the smoke-filled room doesn't,
right.
It sounds a step backward,
yes,
for democracy.
Yes, no, absolutely, right. So this in a way, but there's a lesson in that, which is that there's a way in which our current system is, you know, it's clearly an improvement on the old system, but it's a double-edged system. I mean, it opens the door for demagogues, the post-1972 election system.
I mean, to that end, I just want to ask you about if we could go as deep as we possibly could, even deeper than the level of hyper-partisanship, about what's driving what seems like a slow erosion of American democracy. I mean, is it things like rampant inequality, racism, the weakening of public education, those things put together lead to this outcome of a weakening of democracy?
I think one of the factors, which is we touch on in the book but don't develop much in the book, is almost unprecedented inequality. We now have reached levels of income inequality higher than any time since before the Depression, and by some measures, close to highest levels of income inequality ever. Now, the primary focus, though, of the book is a little bit different. We think that race and culture ultimately are driving this polarization. Three things have happened since the 1960s to contribute to this. First of all, the civil rights movement and the success of the civil rights movement led to a massive migration of Southern whites from the Democratic to the Republican Party. Secondly, large-scale immigration transformed the demographics of this country, and the vast majority of immigrants ended up in the Democratic Party. And third, since Reagan, we have a massive migration of evangelicals, which used to be in both parties, equally split between both parties, are now overwhelmingly Republican. So whereas in the 1950s and the 1960s, even the early 70s, both parties were demographically very similar. They were basically both white Christian parties through the 1960s. Now we have two parties that are demographically very different. The Democrats are a party of basically urban educated whites or urban secular whites and a diversity of ethnic minorities. And the Republicans have become essentially a white Christian party.
So let me just jump in here. Are you saying that one of the reasons why our democracy may be imperiled is racism?
I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. So white Christians are not just any group, right? White Christians were a dominant electoral majority not long ago.
They were the nexus of power, exactly.
So our society has transformed over 50 years, and many white Christians, not all Republican voters, but many Republican voters feel like the country that they grew up with is being taken away from them.
Understood. And this now, is we've heard I, this before, but what, I guess what I'm saying is, what does it say about the inherent strengths or weaknesses of the American democratic experiment that if in this evolution, this transformation, we're talking about how American democracy might die?
Here's what we think it says. The democratic norms that sustained us in the 20th century in many, many positive ways, in which the two parties accepted each other as legitimate and basically played nice. That was founded on racial exclusion. Those norms were created and sustained in an overwhelmingly white Christian society. What we haven't done yet is adapt to a diverse society based on racial equality.
So to get us back to the question of parties and their role in all of this leaves me feeling very depressed because it's the very same party leadership, specifically, I'm going to say, on the Republican side, that I don't see making any moves, having any drive or any meaningful desire to change this trajectory. You're shaking your head. Maybe am I being too pessimistic here?
So there's things for politicians and for parties to do on both sides. So, I mean, one of the things that we think is that first of all, the Republican Party needs to diversify.
Give me a little bit of hope, because you talk about how sort of a party reckoning is possible. And you look to the former West Germany.
Yeah.
West Germany as an example. Yeah. Can you just briefly tell us about that?
Yeah. So one of the key shapers of German political life through the 19th and 20th century was a dysfunctional right in Germany. And it was only after World War II that the German center right was refounded on a democratic basis. And so that's a model, but it's not a very exciting model at some level, because what was required was the devastation and tragedy of World War for the right to finally understand in Germany that it needed to be refounded on a democratic basis.
You close your book by saying that, you quote Daniel Ellen, also from Harvard, the remarkable Daniel Ellen, that basically the challenge, the great American challenge, is that we as a nation are trying to attempt something that has never been attempted before in humanity, right? In her words, it says, build a genuine multi-ethnic democracy where political, social, and economic equality are all achieved. Do you still believe that that is indeed actually possible in the United States?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, this requires creative political leadership. It requires active citizenry. And these are the things, you know, that we hope can happen. And one of the purposes of the book is, again, to look beyond just Donald Trump and to kind of put the full scale of the challenge in front of us.
Yeah. Look, if any democracy in the world is going to do it, it's ours. We have the oldest, most successful constitution in the world. We have very robust democratic institutions. We are a society that has successfully assimilated ethnic minorities in the past. So, yeah, if there's a country in the world that's capable of doing it, it's ours.
Well, the new book is How Democracies Die. It's by Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. Professors, thank you so very much for coming in. It's a remarkable book, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
The U.S. Labor Department said today that the economy added 200,000 jobs in January, and the unemployment rate held steady at 4.1%, another month of strong numbers. And joining us now is Cardiff Garcia, co-host of NPR's podcast, The Indicator from Planet Money. He's in New York. Cardiff, hi, and welcome to NPR, by the way.
Jeremy, thanks very much. Great to be here as a colleague.
Exactly.
And not just as a friend. Yeah.
Well, and start by telling us about these numbers. It seems pretty good, is it?
A very good jobs report, and I should say roughly in line with the jobs reports of the last few months. You mentioned 200,000 jobs added in January. Well, the average for the last 3 months is 190,000. That's very good for an economy at this point in a recovery. We're now going on, 8 years?
Right.
Almost 9 years into the recovery. So that is a very healthy sign, yeah.
And the unemployment rate holding steady at 4.1%. Is that full employment, or can it even go lower than that?
Oh, it can definitely go lower. Full employment is kind of a murky concept, right? But the thing to look for is whether or not the unemployment rate is falling enough to drive up wages and salaries. Because what happens when unemployment goes low is that companies then have to start competing for workers, and that means they have to offer more money and benefits and things like that. And we're seeing some encouraging signs that might be happening. I would stress it's still early days yet, but in this very report, we saw that over the past year, wages have gone up by 2.9%, and that is, in fact, a slight acceleration on what we've seen in the last few years. So, yeah, again, don't want to get overexcited, but this is at least tentatively very good news.
This report also finds that the unemployment rate for African Americans actually jumped up to 7.7% after we've heard so much from President Trump about how low the black unemployment rate is, historic lows. What's going on there now?
Well, it's no longer true that it's at a historic low because of this jump. But to sort of clear the air on that very strange debate going on about this specific number, the African-American unemployment rate has been falling for a while. It has been falling from a very high peak right after the recession when it got to almost 17%. It's now at 7.7%, and that decline has been fairly gradual. But it's worth mentioning that that is still a much higher unemployment rate than either the overall unemployment rate, which is 4.1%, or the unemployment rate for white workers, which is at just about 3.5%. So that is a persistent gap. It's one that in historical terms has shrunk lately, but it's still a very big gap and one that we should keep paying attention to despite all of the kind of short-term nonsensical rhetorical back and forth that you hear sometimes.
You tweeted today that the percent of people working part-time for economic reasons is still not down to pre-recession levels. What does that tell you?
Yeah, so this is an interesting figure because what happens in a recession is that a lot of companies who have full-time workers, they sometimes start scaling their hours back. They go down to part-time. But those workers, make no mistake, would rather be full-time. And like the other indicators, this has been improving ever since the recovery started. So that used to be about twice as high. The share of the labor force who is part-time but would rather be full-time is now at about 3%. But I'll tell you what, before the recession started, it was at 2.6%. So some improvement, but still some work left to be done there. A lot of these part-time workers would still rather be full-time.
That's Cardiff Garcia, co-host of the podcast The Indicator from Planet Money. Cardiff, thank you.
Jeremy, always a pleasure.
This Sunday in Minneapolis, the New England Patriots are back in the Super Bowl for the third time in 4 years and looking for a second straight title. They'll face the Philadelphia Eagles. Now, it's the Eagles' first time back to the Super Bowl since 2005, and they've never won the big game. So what's it like to be an Eagles super fan? Let's ask Nick Martino. He's 28, works in tech sales, and lives just a few miles from Eagle Stadium. And he says he goes to every home game, and he even went on Christmas night when it was just 10 degrees. And he joins us now from Philadelphia. Nick, welcome to Here and Now.
Hey, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm going to guess, though, that you're doing even better. I mean, how excited are you for the Super Bowl?
I've had a countdown on my computer all week. I'm completely checked out of work right now. I'm ready to fly out tomorrow morning.
You're ready to fly out tomorrow morning. So how long have you been waiting for this? The Eagles did go to the Super Bowl in 2005, but I understand that this is like a thing that's been on your bucket list.
Yeah, it's been at the top of my bucket list. And in 05, I was in ninth grade. Couldn't exactly get down there myself, considering money and my age. So it's been up there. And, the Eagles have fallen short many years.
But this may be their time again. I mean, you were at the NFC Championship game when the Eagles clinched the title. Can you just take us back to that moment? I mean, what was it like and how did you feel when you were looking, staring down the clock and you thought, we're going to the Super Bowl?
Well, I knew I already bought tickets and airline previous to the game. So I didn't tell anybody until 4 minutes left in the game when we were up 31. I'm like, all right, I can start telling people. Internally, I was freaking out the whole game.
So you bought your Super Bowl tickets before the NFC Championship.
Yeah, I did. Once I knew the Vikings would be in it, I bought them because I knew I could sell them if the Eagles lost.
Smart move. You're definitely in sales, yeah. Aren't you? That's really smart.
Yeah.
Hey, so let me ask you, though. I mean, how much did it cost you? How much did the plane ticket, the Super Bowl tickets? I mean, are you staying – you must be staying overnight there too.
Yeah. So – the plane tickets was cheap because I booked it in November with my Southwest points because I knew I could get it back.
Yeah.
So, and the hotel, my buddy wasn't at the game. He was in charge of that. So we got that for two nights. There's four of us in a room for two nights for like $700. And then the tickets include a tailgate and everything. And that was around, altogether, around $4,000 a ticket.
$4,000 per ticket?
Yeah.
You know what, though? I mean, if this is on your bucket list and you're a never say die Eagles fan, it's worth it, right?
I see the prices now. I didn't get ripped off considering, you should never pay $4,000 for a game. If it's going to be a game, it's going to be this game.
Yeah. Well, I have to ask you, if the Eagles win on Sunday, it would be their first Super Bowl win in franchise history. So if that happens, how are you going to celebrate?
Well, first, I'll manage my way to the airport at some point. I have a 6 a.m. flight coming home Monday. I'll rest up, and then I'll get ready for the parade, which would be Tuesday or Wednesday. But nobody wants to actually talk about the details because last time we talked about the parade details in 05, the Patriots used it as material.
Yeah. Now, I understand that you got a tattoo after the Phillies won the World Series.
I do.
Are you hoping to get a matching Eagles tattoo?
I am. I've promised everyone. I said it won't happen unless they win the Super Bowl. So there's a group of my buddies who paid for the last one after the Phillies won, because I was at that game when they won the World Series in 08. So,
where's the tattoo?
To keep it G-rated, my right cheek.
Sorry, I had to ask. I was just curious.
Yeah. Yeah. My parents weren't happy at the time. They're over it now. They like it now.
So last question. I mean, clearly you love this team. What does it mean to you to be an Eagles fan? And why do you love them so much?
I mean, I grew up in Bucks County. I grew up in the area. My grandpa went to the 1960 championship game. I played football. It's just been a part of my life. It's part of my family. My whole family loves it. My dad passed away 3 years ago. He has a stone in the Eagles walkway as you walk into the stadium. So that's part of my family too. So I'm the oldest of four too. So it's more than just football. It's part of the community. So, yeah. And just the vibe right now in the city and how everyone is right now. It's just, you haven't seen it in a while.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, Nick Martino, Philadelphia Eagles superfan, he's getting ready to head to Minnesota for the Super Bowl. And Nick, it's been so great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Can I say one thing?
Yeah.
E-A-G-L-E-S, Eagles!
Thanks so much, Nick.
Thank you. Take care.
The New England Patriots, as we mentioned a couple of minutes ago, hope to win their sixth Super Bowl championship in 16 years. And perhaps no one has been more mesmerized by the team's unprecedented success than its youngest fans, who aspire to the Pats' winning ways. But as Tobias Smith reports, too much winning may actually be sending the wrong message to some kids.
Last year, when the Patriots were almost hopelessly behind in the Super Bowl, Pats wide receiver Julian Edelman was relentless.
Gotta believe, bro. Gotta believe, boys!
The Patriots' staggering comeback in that game epitomizes their brand, exceeding expectations and excellence. From the once scrawny quarterback who was drafted 199th out of 200, who became an NFL legend, to many other guys once counted out, including Edelman, who wrote his story into a children's book about Jules the Squirrel.
Let me join your game, he shouts. You're too weak, says the Eagle.
Edelman recently read Flying High at a local preschool.
So all the guys wouldn't let him play.
That's not nice.
But this is how you deal with it.
It needs no spoiler alert. With hard work, Jules the Squirrel makes the team and in the sequel makes an epic catch, propelling his team toward their stunning win.
I always say, no dream is too big.
At home, with an injury that sidelined him this season, Edelman says he hopes to inspire kids as he was growing up.
Nothing's easy. It's a grind. You're going to have a relentless mindset, and you really got to believe.
Ready, Tommy? Hike.
At a YMCA outside Boston, that can-do attitude has trickled down to the kids playing flag football, like Tommy Salem and Maya Schwartzberg.
It's my dream to follow in Tom Brady's footsteps and be famous for comebacks, and you just keep on trying.
Yeah, like when I play football with my brothers, I keep on trying no matter what my brothers say about how they're so much better than I am.
Zach says that, not me.
It's all a great lesson in determination, but the Pats' unprecedented winning record may also have created something of a monster ego and unrealistic expectations in kids like Owen Levine and Tommy.
What if it seems really impossible, like you want to fly?
Well, I mean, that would be a little tough, but I mean, practice, and I guess you could do it someday.
Can little boys fly?
No, but like Julian Edelman said, just believe, and it'll probably come true.
A mom on the sideline, Amy DeTomaso, says there's a fine line between encouraging big dreams and setting kids up to fail.
Not everybody's going to be Tom Brady. Sometimes they need a dose of reality.
DeTomaso says when some kids take winning for granted, confidence can turn to arrogance. And she says kids like her son can easily overlook all the hard work that goes along with all that believing.
He says, I'm going to be a famous basketball player. And I said, well, you have to practice. He said, no, I already know everything.
That's the thing about confidence. It can just as soon sap your motivation if you believe that superstars get that way from some innate talent rather than hard work.
They're not gods. This is not magic. It's not a gift.
Stanford psychology professor Carol Dweck sees the Patriots as a poster team for what she calls the growth mindset, the belief that abilities are earned, not inherited. Dweck says Edelman is right when he says you gotta believe.
People go farther when they believe they can grow their abilities. No guarantee, but it does raise the odds.
It's not easy for this lifelong New York fan to admit she admires the Patriots, but Dweck says there can also be a dark side to outsized expectations.
Having people tell you that losing is not an option could in some cases, I'm not saying in this case, but could in some cases make people feel I have to win at all costs.
No doubt the Pats are always looking for that extra edge, whether Tom Brady's avocado ice cream or the less wholesome allegations for which they've apologized or dismissed as bogus, jealous jabs. But that's also a lesson for kids. In many ways, Edelman says, it's harder to stay at the top than to get there.
Because that's when it's like everyone's out for you when you're at the top. And how you hold yourself is a huge thing.
Which speaks to the Patriots' other mantras, ignore the noise and do your job. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
This week, Republican Trey Gowdy and Democrat Bob Brady became the latest congressmen to announce the end of their careers in the House of Representatives. That brings the total number of representatives who are retiring or leaving their seats to run for another office to 49. 34 of them are Republicans, leading some to predict a blue wave in the midterm elections later this year. Joining us for more is Nathan Gonzalez, editor and publisher of Inside Elections. Hi, Nathan.
Thank you for having me.
And how unusual is it for so many people who are serving in Congress to decide they don't want to run again?
Well, depending on how you want to slice it, we're above average and we might be reaching historic levels. And that's the most Republicans I've seen leaving going back to at least the 1930s.
And how much of that is about Republicans looking forward and saying, well, we might not keep the House in November, and so I don't want to be, in the minority?
I think there are a lot of different factors going on. I think you have a number of term limited chairmen on the Republican side who, if they were reelected, would not be in the position of seniority that they have now. I think there are some who are wary of having the first competitive race either of their lifetime or in recent history. I think you also have a group of Republicans who are trying to make that jump to statewide office. I mean, remember the Democratic senators are on the defensive and up for reelection in some states that Donald Trump carried. So you have House Republicans saying, I want to take that jump, or you have a huge crop of gubernatorial races across the country. And then you have this other group of members who can't seem to keep their hands or their feelings to themselves, and they've been kind of pushed into retirement.
So let's take a look at a couple of them, starting with the one that shocked a lot of people this week, Trey Gowdy, the South Carolina Republican. Why is he not running?
Well, Trey Gowdy, he's not leaving a vulnerable seat, but I think he's done with it. He's probably done with it in a different way than Pennsylvania Republican Charlie Dent, who has grown frustrated with the most conservative members of his own party. But I think it's a good example of how all of these open seats aren't created equal. Trey Gowdy leaving Congress doesn't really create a vulnerable open seat for Republicans, where someone like a Congressman Rodney Frelinghuysen of New Jersey, who recently announced his retirement, that does create a problem.
Well, he's the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, which is about the most powerful place you can be in Congress.
Right. And I think for someone like Congressman Frelinghuysen to go from that position to not being a chairman, it's hard to go from the varsity back to the JV. And he was facing a serious reelection effort. I mean, it's pretty remarkable that his family has been around in part of New Jersey politics since the founding of our country. But he was going to face a real reelection fight.
What about the Democrats who are not running again? What do you make of that?
Well, there are fewer Democrats that aren't running again, but some of them are open seats that they're going to have to defend if they want to get to the majority. I think one of the most vulnerable Democratic open seats is Congressman Tim Walz of Minnesota. He's running for governor, but that's a seat that Democrats are going to have to work hard to defend, because in order to gain the 24 seats they need to get the majority in the House, they have to reelect all their own, because if they lose Tim Walz's seat, and pick up another seed, then all they've done is broken even.
There's another name that a lot of people know, and that is Daryl Issa. He is leaving his seat in Southern California, prominent Republican there. But Hillary Clinton won his district, right? So is this just he doesn't want to run in a competitive election?
Right. I mean, his district, that's Orange County, went for Hillary Clinton, went for a Democratic presidential nominee for the first time since 1936. And so Orange County is getting a lot of attention, and Democrats see the opportunity. And this is a good example of where Congressman Issa retiring or leaving this district may actually help Republican chances. He had become such a polarizing figure with his investigations of Hillary Clinton and Benghazi that taking him out and allowing Republicans an opportunity to nominate someone who's a little more of a fresher face could actually help the party's chances of holding that seat.
We should also mention that there are a number of lawmakers who are leaving because of scandal.
Correct. Whether it's a Congressman Blake Farenthold of Texas or Pat Meehan of Pennsylvania, there are these group of Republicans who have created their own problems and have created these open seats where we weren't expecting them.
What does all this tell you about the upcoming midterm elections?
I think these open seats are a good opportunity for Democrats in their effort to regain the majority. If you look back at some previous congressional waves, midterm waves, open seats have been a big part of it. Looking back at 2006 and 2008, when Democrats did very well, about a third of the Democratic gains in 06 and over half of the Democratic gains in 2008 came from picking up open seats. So these make it easier for Democrats because they don't have to knock off some well-financed, entrenched incumbents. They can take a gamble and try to defeat someone who should be easier to defeat, particularly if you have the political wind at your back.
That's Nathan Gonzalez, who's editor and publisher of Inside Elections. A lot of races to watch, and it seems like more and more by the week. Nathan, thank you.
Thank you.